You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
As a plant-based cheese company, Daiya has never talked about beef in an ad before, because someone somewhere once had a beef with saying beef and plant-based together. So putting a slice of Daiya cheese on a beef burger, not okay. Well, our delicious melty cheese has a beef with your beef about beef, because any step towards plant-forward eating is a step in the right direction. Daiya, 100% plant-based, even if you're not. Now made with Daiya Oat Cream Blend.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. In 1990, authors Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman published a quirky novel about an angel and a demon who conspired to sabotage the end of days because, well, they've grown quite accustomed to their comfortable life here on Earth. Gaiman and Pratchett's book, Good Omens, went on to win numerous book awards and has had a loyal following ever since. And for nearly 30 years, Pratchett and Gaiman planned to adapt their book into a movie with various names including Terry Gilliam, Robin Williams, and Johnny Depp attached to the project at one time or another. Though sadly, Pratchett would not live to see their book turned into a movie, Good Omens now finally comes out as a 6-part television series on Amazon Prime Video starting May 31st. And today, Neil Gaiman joins me on the podcast to talk about the book's long journey to the screen and his lifelong friendship with Terry Pratchett. Neil recalls the origin of the book as a fable about nature versus nurture, his deathbed vow to his co-author to see it through as a television series, and why he personally took on the reins as showrunner. He reveals why he wanted to add more angels to the television series and why he wanted to give his characters a more epic backstory, and opens up about the on-screen cameo that was just too painful for him to film. Neil talks about his writing process, how he manages to avoid distractions, and why he chooses to write across many different mediums, including comic books, movies, novels, and perhaps even an original Broadway musical. And finally, Neil tells the story of the time he and Good Omens star Michael Sheen went to dinner at a trendy LA sushi restaurant, only to be interrupted by a federal raid and told they'd been served endangered whale meat. Coming up with author Neil Gaiman in just a moment. Neil Gaiman is a prolific author of short fiction, novels, comic books, graphic novels, nonfiction, audio theater, and films. His works include the comic book series The Sandman and novels Stardust, American Gods, Coraline, and The Graveyard Book. He has won numerous awards, including the Hugo, Nebula, and Bram Stoker Awards, as well as the Newbery and Carnegie Medals. Now Neil Gaiman has adapted his very first novel, which he co-wrote with the late Terry Pratchett, into a 6-part television series for Amazon Prime Video. Good Omens launches Friday, May 31st on Amazon. Neil Gaiman, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
For anyone listening who I guess may not have read the novel and just happens to stumble upon Good Omens on Amazon, I want to give them a brief synopsis just so they know what we're talking about here. The story centers around a demon named Crowley, not Crowley, and an angel named Aziraphale, who have kind of been friendly competitors, I guess, for souls on Earth for millennia now. And suddenly the apocalypse is nigh and they've grown rather accustomed to their earthly pleasures and being here on this planet. And so they conspire together to stop the apocalypse, much to the consternation of their respective bosses. Almost 30 years after publication, I think it is now, it's still such an original idea for a novel. How did you and your original co-author, Terry Pratchett, come up with such a premise?
We came up with it, I think, in much the way that Columbus found America, which is to say, we thought we were going somewhere else.
Oh, really?
What we fell in love with as a premise to take us through the book was the idea of a story about an 11-year-old Antichrist who ought to have gone off to be Damien and instead is growing up with nobody knowing that he's there in a little English village and exploring questions of nature versus nurture. And that was the place, I think, that we began when we were writing. But the baby swap over had to be screwed up. So Crowley came into existence in order to screw up the baby swap.
Interesting. And
then Aziraphale came into existence because Crowley needed someone to talk to and argue with. Uh-huh. And
so the main character is kind of sprung out of this idea of wanting to do something about nature versus nurture.
Exactly.
Interesting.
And then suddenly we followed them through the book. And along with witches and witch finders, along with all sorts of peculiar and glorious characters of the final days, including Atlanteans and Americans. at the end of the day, we wound up writing a novel about love, about nature and nurture, about what it means to take care of the world, about why the world ending is not necessarily a good thing.
Mm-hmm. That's something I never understood, is these people who are all looking forward to the Armageddon.
Exactly.
Why? That sounds terrible.
It really
does. I enjoy life.
And I think, you know, there's part of me that goes, well, actually, if you really think that it is a morally defensible point of view to be plucked up from the earth, placed on clouds, and look down at the poor people down there, you know, having to deal with the seas turning to blood and everything, I'm not sure I do. So we had an immense amount of fun writing our novel 30 years ago. And then about 8 or 9 years ago, Terry Gilliam, who had wanted to make it into a film, suggested to me that it might make television.
Oh, interesting. It was Terry Gilliam who suggested it for television, huh?
Terry,
because he had developed it as a film for a while,
did,
right?
And a brilliant one at that. He had a great script and stuff like that, but he never made it happen. And I remember him just saying to me, you know, Neil, the world of television is changing. And I think that might be the best place for Good Omens.
Huh. He was ahead of his time in that sense.
He's very smart.
Yeah.
And Terry Pratchett and I started pursuing people to make it. And we couldn't find anybody who was prepared to say yes. And in the end, Terry turned to me and said, you have to do this. He had Alzheimer's. He knew that he wasn't going to be around for a long time. And then he died.
Wow.
And suddenly it was, you know, it was a last request. It had become this sort of moral imperative.
Talk about pressure.
And so I left Terry's funeral. I flew back to America and I started writing the first episode.
Why do you think it was so important for him to see Good Omens taken to television?
I think there were a number of reasons, and I think the biggest for Terry was the morality of Good Omens and the idea of Good Omens. Like, you know, it's a very moral book.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that one of the stars of it is a demon. and I think Terry really felt that the world was ready for Good Omens, and there had never been a great television series of Terry's stuff. There have been a few made-for-television movies.
Right.
But the idea of something really good, something as good as the best of Doctor Who or whatever your favorite TV show happens to be, that hadn't been made of Terry's stuff, hadn't been made of my stuff. Although I was much luckier in films.
Right.
And Terry.
Right.
Had been. Yeah. You know, I had things like Coraline and Stardust. So I think Terry decided that it was going to happen. He wanted it to happen. And there was only one person he was willing to entrust it to.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly I was making a television show for my dead friend. Yeah.
As a result of that, do you think that you've been more protective over Good Omens than you might have been over the years over some of your solo works that came to Hollywood?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. what I tend to do when people ask me if they can make things or whatever is go, well, yeah, go do something wonderful. Do something that would surprise me. Make something cool. Sometimes you get lucky and you get a Coraline out of that because you give someone amazing and creative their head. And also, I don't think you should be looking over someone's shoulder all the time saying, no, not like that, like that. No, no, don't. Oh, no, you'll break it. No. You know, that would just drive me mad. And so I don't like it when people, I don't do it to other people. Mm-hmm. But what I did do with Good Omens was say, right, this is the show. It's my job to make it. And I'm going to make it. And I'm going to make a show that Terry would have loved, and I'm going to make a show that I'm proud of. And it meant that when people would say, well, what about this bit? Or, you know, can we lose this thing over here? I would mentally check in with the Terry Pratchett on my shoulder. And
oh, really?
He would say, you know, no, that stays. And I would say, I'm sorry, that stays. And because I'd made myself showrunner as well as writer, I had the power to say, no, that stays.
Yeah, because unlike your other series, American Gods, you are the showrunner on Good Omens. What has that experience been like for you, having that much power?
Well, you know, I think probably the power has gone to my head. It's probably time to now declare war on another TV show.
Yeah.
No, it's... I've been a writer before. Being a writer on television is a very strange process. Because while it's you and the words, you're in charge. You're God. You're the most important person on the show. Nothing happens without you and that typewriter or that computer. The moment you're done and handed over, your opinions matter less than the most junior member of the art department.
True.
You no longer have a say. You don't have a say in what gets cut. You don't have a say in what gets changed.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I have experienced, you know, I've won awards for scripts for television. I've also written scripts for television that were widely regarded as dogs. And I, as the writer, get to go, well, actually, the award ones and the dog ones were pretty much of a standard when they left me.
Okay.
It was what happens after that.
So what's the
variable? It can be casting. It can be, you know, literally the art department deciding to rewrite a sequence to make it easier to shoot or whatever. And the decisions are not yours. Mm. And I just went, okay, the decisions have to be mine. And I will obviously be reasonable. We do not have an unlimited budget. We don't have unlimited facilities. But somebody has to be the one who can say, yeah, we're not actually cutting that bit.
Mm-hmm.
Or that bit stays. Or conversely, yeah, and this bit that everybody likes, I'm cutting it because actually it doesn't matter to the plot. And it doesn't matter to what happens on the thing if that goes.
You have frequently expressed your frustrations with the studio system and the whole development process throughout your career. Has that made you cynical about the entertainment industry in general?
No, not really. I mean, I still think that the development process is kind of fundamentally pointless. I love the fact that Good Omens didn't have a development process.
Oh, really?
The development process of Good Omens was...
But the adaptation?
I took the novel.
Right.
I went, I think this is 6 episodes. I went, it's a 300-page novel, so I'm going to do about 50 pages. an episode, go to page 50, put in a marker, read through the novel, go, ah, okay, well, Crowley and Aziraphale really aren't in chapter 3. So I think I'll do a pre-credit sequence covering 6,000 years in which we get to follow their friendship because otherwise they wouldn't really be in this very much. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that episode where you go throughout history and you see them at the crucifixion and you see them at the French Revolution. Just the fun of them at those events is one thing, but it's also nice to be able to track the evolution of this relationship over the millennia.
Yeah.
I found that very rewarding.
Well, thank you. But what I love about that is I didn't have to sell it to anybody or explain it to anybody or anything. I just wrote my scripts.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they were done, we you know, I found a director, we cast it, and we started making it.
It's a nice luxury to be able to have a studio that can work with you and let you do that, isn't it?
What was nice, I think, also was the coming together of the BBC, mm-hmm. who are very used to writer-led projects.
Yeah, true, true.
And Amazon, who are very used to signing large checks, mm-hmm. but also having faith in their creative people. Mm-hmm. So it meant that the BBC, who are not used to signing large checks for things, you know, they were just freaking out, many of them, at the kind of the fact that we actually had a budget here, yeah. and they weren't quite sure what to do with it.
When you were adapting, I think it was probably about 400 pages, the novel, into a TV series, how did you go about deciding what you wanted to cut and what you wanted to add?
I knew that I wanted my angels in there. Mm-hmm. I knew that heaven and hell needed to be there. And Terry Pratchett and I had talked a lot over the years about angels, about heaven and hell, about how that was all going to work. So it had to be part of the thing that we were making. I knew that.
Mm-hmm. And the angels are a great addition. Particularly, I love John Hamm as the angel Gabriel, who is kind of the typical dickish office boss. even in heaven, you have to deal with office politics and that sort of thing. Huh?
That was, that was the lovely thing about casting John, which was going, okay, I've written Gabriel as this awful boss, and now I have to find somebody, and I need to have, I've got Michael Sheen as Aziraphale. Mm-hmm. So whoever it is needs to be sort of taller, better dressed, more imposing, and the kind of boss that you really just want to punch in the face.
Yeah.
Because they are both ignorant and certain of their correctness. And I asked John Hamm, and I was lucky. John Hamm was a huge fan of the novel. When he was at college, and it was like, you know, would you do this? And he was like, yes, absolutely.
And for once, we finally get to see Michael Sheen in a project where he's not playing the prick. I loved him as a nice guy for once.
Well, a lot of that, honestly, is because Michael's my friend.
Oh,
he
is.
I met Michael in 2010 before the Oscars. We met for dinner at a place called The Hump, which was in Santa Monica Airport.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that the place that got closed for having whale sushi?
I was going to say, so Michael and I were having dinner. We'd gone there. We are sitting there having dinner. The place is pretty much empty. And in fact, we're the first customers there.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, there are people marching in with sort of FBI style Bureau of Game and Fishery jackets on, and they go into the kitchen, they seal everything off, they sit all the staff down. We assume initially that maybe it's an immigration raid, but why are they Game and Fishery? And then they're like, ladies and gentlemen, please pay for your meals and leave. And everybody else just left. And Michael and I, because we're English, paid for our meal.
Good for you.
And no,
you're
so that
kidding.
Was
that actually happened while the two of you were in
while
the
while
restaurant.
We were there, and we had no idea what was going on. Like 3 or 4 days later, there was an article in the LA Times, and that explained what had happened in the Hump while we were there. But we kept telling people, this thing just happened. It was so strange.
I can't believe that. Yeah, because there's something like they were selling whale meat sushi or something.
They were, right? But what was even weirder. The awful thing is that Michael and I probably ate it.
Yeah.
And Michael and I going in and ordering the omakase, the please feed us stuff, while they were actually under observation, because they needed to know that this, they needed to know. I read an article like months later saying that they had needed to know that these guys had the two kinds of illicit whale meat. this endangered whale, and that they were serving it to people. But the thing that is mad, I still don't get, is they were only serving it as omakase, which is to say chef's choice. And occasionally we would say to the chef, He was Japanese. He spoke almost no English. And we would say, what is this thing we're eating? And he would say, oh, in Japan, it is called kissing fish. And it's like, we are no wiser than anything.
Yeah. Who would guess that's whale?
But nobody was there for whale. They were just being served this illicit whale. Very, very peculiar.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Neil Gaiman when we come back in just a minute. Keeping pace with the many changes in technology is critical. Stay up to date and master the tech skills that companies want with a Udacity Nano degree. Udacity's Nano degree programs use the most effective online methods to teach technology subjects. Right now, I'm taking a course in digital marketing on Udacity, and their Nano degrees cover a wide range of tech careers from foundational computer programming to artificial intelligence, and even how to program a self-driving car. Udacity works directly with industry experts to design programs that include real-world projects, providing you with true hands-on learning. With experienced reviewers to grade your work, you'll develop a job-ready portfolio that showcases the right tech skills. Udacity's flexible pay-as-you-learn monthly program lets you learn at your own pace, and they'll work with you to create a custom learning plan that fits your schedule. In addition, you'll get personal one-on-one support from technical mentors who can answer your questions and keep you on track. Udacity provides a full suite of career services, including coaching and resume review, to help you land the job you want. Start your future today and be in demand. Go to udacity.com/kick and use code KICK to save 10%. That's Udacity, spelled UDACITY.com/kick. Code KICK to save 10% today. And now, back to the show. I heard somewhere along the way that you and Terry Pratchett used to say that whenever you finally got Good Omens to the screen, the two of you were going to be extras sitting in a table in the background of the sushi restaurant scene. Was that a bittersweet moment when you finally got to put that on TV?
You know, I wrote the scene in a sushi restaurant. Terry and I, it was a standing joke between us. There would be a sushi restaurant scene and we were going to be extras in it. So very early in episode one, I wrote a scene in a sushi restaurant. And I kind of figured when I wrote it, yeah, I'll be in the background there eating my sushi and maybe we'll get Terry's hat on the table or something. And then that night, I couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. You know, we're shooting and I'm like, you know, I don't want to be in it. Just get the background people to be background. I'm good over here. Mm.
Tough. Because you two had a friendship for many years. You weren't just co-authors, right?
Oh, we were friends first. You know, we met in January 1985. I was a young journalist. I'd been given a copy of a book called The Color of Magic, which was about to come out in paperback. Terry was a basically completely unknown author who was working as a publicist for the or PR department of the Central Electricity Generating Board.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
You know, it would be another 4 years before he retired. But we hit it off. We had the same kind of sense of humor. We had the same kinds of minds. We became friends.
Either in the original novel, Good Omens, or in the adapting of it for television, were there aspects of your personal friendship that made it into the relationship between Aziraphale and Crowley?
Well, Crowley, it's funny. In my first draft of the first 5,000 words of Good Omens, Crowley was a very sweet, slightly ineffectual demon. He was actually a lot more, he was a demon, but he was a lot more like Aziraphale. Mm-hmm. What Terry did was then split the character into Aziraphale and Crowley. And his version of Crowley was basically his way of pointing fun at me. You know, I was the one dressed in black with wearing dark glasses when I didn't need them.
I was going to ask, which one were you?
Well, it was, so people say, was Crowley like a self-insertion? And I'm like, no. Crowley was Terry making fun of me. And so some of the best moments of Crowley jokes where you're making fun of Crowley are Terry just making fun of me.
I heard that you and Terry at one point were working on a sequel to Good Omens. Were there elements from the sequel that made it into the TV series?
Absolutely. Yeah, we were going to do a novel called 668, The Neighbor of the Beast. we never did. The angels really were the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. We had plans for the angels and plans for heaven and for hell. And a lot of what we came up with for the sequel, for our angels, was stuff that I then took from that unwritten sequel and put into Good Omens, which I think is why the angels always feel so very much part of Good Omens. They don't feel like we've come up with something else. They don't feel like, doesn't feel like, here's the novel and here's the stuff tacked onto it.
Yeah. And I wonder, in taking these biblical themes and turning them on their head, have you gotten much pushback from Christians or those who might not have a very good sense of humor about that kind of thing?
You know, when Terry and I wrote the novel, we were at least a little bit expecting some kind of pushback. We were, you know, at that point, Salman Rushdie was in hiding.
Oh, right.
And I remember talking to Terry about seeing if we could get in touch with Salman and you know, see if he had a spare room in the back that we could use if necessary. But instead, a year later, I remember the surprise at discovering that we were nominated for an award for religious fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I can tell, nobody was ever
really
mad at us.
But the British seem to have more of a sense of humor about that kind of thing. I think back to like Monty Python and the Life of Brian. They can kind of take a joke about religion. Maybe that comes with being a culture that has gone through several religious transitions over the centuries, sometimes more comfortable than others.
I think that's true. But I also think, you know, in America, you have a country of over 300 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's over 300 million different opinions. One of the things that I did in Good Omens, which was a small thing, but it was done for a reason, was I make Adam and Eve black.
Yeah.
And we meet Adam and Eve in the first 4 minutes, 3 or 4 minutes of the show. And I figure, look, if you're the kind of person who is going to have incredible problems with the idea of a black Adam and Eve, you're the kind of person who's going to have incredible problems with Good Omens.
Yeah.
And here you go. You can stop watching now. It's okay. It's not for you. You don't have to get offended. You don't have to stop other people watching it. Just go now.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And if you're the kind of person who goes, oh, black Adam and Eve, I haven't seen that before. That makes sense. Then this is your show.
Yeah.
And you'll love it.
Well, it's certainly a more realistic interpretation of what Adam and Eve probably would have looked like. They wouldn't have looked like they came from Norway.
Well, given that you're setting the Garden of Eden somewhere where the sun is very, very hot, they wouldn't have done.
Are you particularly religious personally? Do you think about heaven and hell and God or whether there's something more or not?
Only as an author, but the wonderful thing about being an author is you're allowed to believe absolutely everything while you're writing.
Mm.
And you're allowed to tell, you know, gods what to do, not to mention angels and demons.
Yeah. As a writer, you are God.
You definitely are.
Yeah. How about Armageddon? Do you give much thought to that with Brexit and Trump and everything? sort of feels a little bit Armageddon-y.
You know, when we wrote the novel, I remember one of us going in, we had a talk about it, and one of us went in, it was me, added in some lines about how weird it was that, you know, the end of the world seemed to be happening now when everybody was getting on so well. And it's a line from a newsreader. I wish we could have that line now.
Yeah.
I wish that it didn't feel so incredibly appropriate to be making a drama for the end times.
I mentioned at the top that you work in a variety of mediums, often, I think, at the same time, from novels and comic books to children's books, movies. Do you find that working in so many different mediums creates an environment for a lot of creative cross-pollinization?
To some extent, but what I really like better than that is just the fact that if I get an idea, I can probably go to the place where it is most appropriate to do.
Oh, interesting.
Which is, you know, it's the equivalent of having an idea and going, okay, are you a short story, a novel, or a poem? But I can also go, are you a short story, a novel, a poem, a stage play, television? What are you? What are you going to be fun in?
Yeah.
And then occasionally you get to write a short story or something and go, you know, you're a really good short story, but I'd love to see the people in you walking around. I'd love to see this thing happen where real things are going on.
How do you make those decisions? When you have an idea for a story in your head, how do you decide this is a graphic novel, this is a comic book, this is going to be a novel?
Sometimes you do it because you go, okay, I think what's important to me is the tone of voice. Okay, if it's what's important to me is the tone of voice, then it's probably prose. Whereas if I'm going, okay, what's really important to me is seeing these people doing this thing. What does it look like? Then I'm going, okay, well, you're probably a movie.
Okay, that's very logical. That completely makes sense.
Yeah, it's, and you know, that really is sort of how it happens. And sometimes I'm wrong.
As simple as that. Oh, really?
You know, I've been wrong.
What's an example of one that maybe should have been done as something else?
Well, Anansi Boys, my novel, I thought for years was probably a movie. And I remember I had like four or five different movie beginnings for Anansi Boys. And I'd start writing it, and then it would sort of peter out. I didn't really get it. And at some point in there, I was talking to an editor of mine at Harper's about doing a book of three different novellas, and said, well, one of them could be Anansi Boys. And she said, well, what's that? And I told her the plot, and she shook her fork at me because we were eating, and she said, that's a novel. And I'm like, is it? And she said, yes, it is. And I'm like, oh, well, okay. So I wrote it.
At some point recently, I think that I read that you're considering doing an original musical for the stage. Now, Coraline had been adapted for the stage, but this would be an original Neil Gaiman musical designed to be put on Broadway or something. What would be the tone of a Neil Gaiman musical?
Well, currently, I'm actually quietly pootering away in the background. Yeah. And again, like everything else in my life, it got put on hold for 2 years while I did Good Omens. And now I'm sort of looking around going, I am, as if I've been in suspended animation.
Yeah.
But working on a little project right now with New York's Public Theater.
Oh, great.
And with Stephen Merritt of the Magnetic Fields Band. And together we're working to craft something. So fingers crossed.
Wow, something to look forward to. What's a typical work day like for you? How do you go about writing?
I haven't had a typical work day now for years.
Oh, really?
I'm in the process of retiring from show running.
Oh, really? So for, on your first show, huh?
Absolutely. So, but for the last 2 years, you know, it's tended to be things like set the alarm for 5:45 for the 6:15 pickup to take you to the location for 7:15 where things are going to be beginning and stumble back in at 10 o'clock at night, unable to think. And during the course of that, just keep going and answer everybody's questions and head off into some kind of little room at some point to rewrite this scene that needs to be rewritten because it needs to be a little bit cheaper or whatever. So there was a certain amount of that.
Yeah.
But I'm really looking forward to becoming somebody who gets up in the morning, deals with urgent email, maybe goes for a run, and then settles in to write.
Yeah. Now, I've read that you're particularly disciplined about not letting yourself get too distracted when you're writing. Do you have certain rules or things that you adhere to?
It used to be fabulous because I'd have a writing cabin which had no Wi-Fi.
Oh, perfect.
And that was great. And then my wife said, okay, I'm not actually having you work in the house anymore. And I was working in the house and in the cabin. So then I had to put Wi-Fi into the cabin. So I built a gazebo mm-hmm. to write in.
Oh, really? How nice.
Even more distant in the woods. We have all of these woods. So I now have a distant wireless-free gazebo. And when I need to write, I go there.
Well, before we go, I just want to say how much I enjoyed the show and also how much I enjoyed the opening credits.
Thank you.
I love the animated sequence there. It almost seems reminiscent of the old PBS mystery Edward Gorey titles.
You know, Nick Offerman said to me when he saw it, he said it's like it was made by the love child of Edward Gorey and Hieronymus Bosch.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And I thought, I can really see that. That's lovely. Yeah. These wonderful people called Peter Anderson Studios made it for us. If there is any justice in the world, they will take all of the opening credits awards that are there to be taken.
Definitely.
Because I think it's the most glorious opening credits. It's the only opening credit sequence of anything where you want to keep watching it every episode. You don't go, okay, we can zoom through the opening credits. You watch it again, even though you've seen it before, because you pick up new details. Mm. You notice new things. And now things that didn't mean anything the last time you saw it, it's like, oh, that's the flying saucer, right?
Well, the 6-part series Good Omens is available on Amazon Prime Video starting Friday, May 31st. Neil Gaiman, thanks so much for talking with me.
You're so welcome.
Thanks again to Neil Gaiman for coming on the podcast. His wonderful series, Good Omens, stars Michael Sheen and David Tennant, and it's available on Amazon Prime Video beginning Friday, May 31st. And if you want to keep up with Neil, visit neilgaiman.com or follow him on Twitter at Neil himself. Master the tech skills that companies want in today's landscape with a Udacity Nano degree. Udacity's flexible pay-as-you-learn nano degree programs include expertly designed real-world projects that fit your busy schedule. You'll also get one-on-one support from technical mentors and a full suite of career coaching services in your program. Start your future today and be in demand. Go to udacity.com/kick and use code KICK to save 10%. That's Udacity, UDACITY.com/kick, code KICK. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.